Surveys of the reading habits of Americans tell us that the number of Americans who read regularly continues to decline. For example, the results of a survey that was published last summer found that only 45% of Americans read for an hour a day, and that was down 51% from 7 years before that. And it seems that these kinds of trends, not only do they hold true for adults, but they also hold true for children. And it's not here that we're talking about people who cannot read. We're talking about people who don't. They're not illiterate. They are illiterate. And people in the education field, teachers and people who are concerned about reading, tell us, of course, if you're interested in building a nation of readers, if you want adults to be readers, then you have to start when they are children. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about things that we can do to connect kids with reading. And this is the first in what we expect will be a series of monthly shows discussing issues involving literacy. And we're very pleased to be partnering in this little project with a local organization here based in Urbana, the National Council of Teachers of English. I guess I shouldn't have said local organization. They are based locally, but it is indeed a national organization of educators in English studies, literacy, and language arts. And they have suggested to us some topics and some guests, and we're pleased to have the input. For our first this morning, we'll be talking with Kylene Beers. She's professor of reading at University of Houston, and for something like 20 years now, she has been interested in and studying why it is that some children, some students, struggle with reading or are reluctant to read, and then has tried to apply that understanding and try to find ways for teachers then to work with kids who are either struggling or reluctant readers. She's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, certainly questions and comments are welcome. If you're in Champaign, Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. But any place else, if it would be a long-distance call around Illinois, Indiana, if you're listening over the airwaves, or in fact, if you're listening on the internet anywhere in the country, you may use our toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Anyone's welcome to call in and ask questions, make comments. We just ask people to try to be brief just so we can keep things moving along. But of course, anyone's welcome to join the conversation. Professor Beers, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
So I'm pleased to be here with you.
I understand this is something that has been a long-standing interest of yours, and in fact was the subject of your dissertation. So this has been something that you've been doing research on and thinking about and writing about and talking about now for a long time.
That's exactly right. When I started teaching in 1979, I was just completely unprepared for what I found in classrooms, which were kids who could read but absolutely did not want to read. And growing up as someone who loved to read and coming from a family of readers, I think I had a very narrow vision of the world and thought everyone out there enjoyed reading.
Mm-hmm.
So the more I spent time with these kids and really began to look at why would they be turning away from something that is so important and critical through their whole life, it just became a real focus of research.
I'm interested in this idea that perhaps if one is a reader, you think everyone is. And I'm continually struck by a lot of the reporting in the media on this very issue, talking about the fact that so few people read. And yet there are so many bookstores, and the bookstores are full of books and they're full of people. And I go there and I think, well, gosh, they say that no one's reading, but there seem to be a lot of people here reading. Yet it seems to be that those folks are a loyal, dedicated minority, people who are passionate about reading and buy books and read books.
It's an overwhelming minority. The most current statistic is about 10% of the population buy about 90% of all the books. So when you're standing there in that bookstore, you are there with a very small number of folks who are out buying books. That doesn't mean that only 10% of the population's reading, because, of course, a lot of folks get books from the library, borrow books from friends. I mean, there's other ways to get to books. But when you're in that bookstore, there's just not many new people who continually walk through.
Mm-hmm. And I think often we tend to, with whatever problem we're talking about, we tend to think that this time, the time that we're in, is somehow worse than any other. And although when you look at the sorts of surveys of reading habits, as I mentioned at the beginning, it does indeed seem to be that the number of Americans that are regular readers has declined. When one looks back in the past, has indeed the number of readers, has there been a significant decline? Has there been a time in the past, some golden time of reading, when everybody was reading?
There seems to be. That's a really great question, and I like the phrase a golden time, because we do talk about a golden time in children's literature when suddenly in the 60s and you begin to have so many more children's books being published than ever before. And so there may have been a time in the 50s and 60s where more adults and beginning to have more kids turn to reading for recreation. The biggest issue has been as the volume of books available to people has increased, the number of people choosing those books has decreased.
Hmm.
And so you begin to say, well, how could that happen? You mentioned a moment ago that comment I made that it's unusual that I grew up as a reader and therefore presumed everyone around me liked to read. And I think that's real interesting, because if you talk to kids who love sports, they're amazed when other kids don't love sports. Or if you talk to kids who love rap music, they're just confused if other kids don't love rap music. You know, once we find what it is we like, we sort of presume all of us around us will like the same thing. And that includes readers. You know, once you find a person who's a reader, they're just confused when other people choose not to like the same thing.
Yeah. One other point, and then I have a caller here I want to get onto, so we won't make them wait. But I think that it does seem to be very striking that at the same time that the number of, we know that the patterns for children parallel those of adults, that is, that overall in Americans they're reading less. It does seem striking that children should be reading less at a time now when it seems, as you mentioned, over the last couple of decades, that there has been a great boom in publishing of children's literature, mm-hmm. not just in terms of volume, but in terms of quality, mm-hmm. Particularly for those readers that we now call the young adult readers. A lot of very, very good fiction and otherwise wonderful books, and it seems particularly sad that we don't have more children taking advantage of the fact that there's all of this great material for them to read.
There are a tremendous number and variety of books, and more than ever there are books for minority children that, if you look back historically, have not been there, where African-American, Asian, Hispanic characters are the central characters. And when you look and say, why isn't that being approached? Why aren't more kids going after this? Then you have to begin to ask what's going on in schools and what's going on at homes that perhaps is keeping that from happening.
Well, we have someone to talk with, and let's do that. This obviously is someone listening on the Internet, because the caller is in Tampa, Florida. Let's go there to our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Kylene, this is Jeff. I wanted to know your opinion of the National Reading Panel report that's come out, and how you think that's going to help or hurt.
Well, the National Reading Panel was a highly select group of researchers who came together to look at what are best reading practices for kindergarten, first grade, up through about fourth grade. For our listeners who aren't familiar with the National Reading Panel, they very strictly looked at research studies that followed a very particular design, and that is an experimental design, where one group of kids receive one type of educational treatment and another group of kids don't. And then this group looked to see what kind of things made the most difference. There's been a lot of talk and reporting and writing about this particular report, because the report itself is incredibly long. It's very laborious to go through, and so there was an executive summary made of the report, that seemed to contradict some of the things that were in the report. And then there was a pamphlet made of the executive summary, which also seemed to contradict some of the things that were in the original report.
Right.
So the question becomes, what did the report really say? And the report really said, you know, we know that comprehension for kids is, helping kids with comprehension is incredibly important. We know that kids need to have a good, strong base in learning how letters and sounds work together. And we don't see that a continued focus on a very strict phonics approach helps kids as they get older learn to read or comprehend better.
Yeah.
I think if people will go back, and this really is targeted toward educators, if we'll go back and take the time to read the original report, which does take time, then there will be a lot less of a focus on creating reading programs that are all about teaching more phonics, because
that's
not where the actual report would have us spend our time.
Yes, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. We have someone here on a cell phone, so we'll get right to them next. Line two, hello.
Yeah, well, this point isn't really about reading per se. It's about the point you said that people have a hard time imagining, you know, gee, I like this. How could anyone else not? I've taught several classes over the last several years, although I'd say I'm mostly a researcher. But and they were in two fairly different areas. And in both cases, I would say that understanding that really became important to connecting with the students.
Mm-hmm.
They just do not think the way you do, you the teacher. I mean, you the teacher picked your position. You know, you selected yourself to go into that job. And if you can't realize that most of the students that are in your class probably didn't pick it, they didn't necessarily want to be. In some cases, they really don't want to be there. And this is at the collegiate level too. I mean, I'm not saying this is, you know, you'd say, oh well, it's younger kids. No. It's college students too. There's classes they're in they don't want to be in.
You know, I think you're exactly right. And if I had that wisdom in 1979 when I was a 22-year-old teacher, I would have been a much happier person that year. I was really referring to that very first year of how incredibly surprised I was.
Oh, I had the same thing. I intellectually knew it, but I didn't really understand it.
And it,
you know, it's like the dog. You got to rub his face in it a couple times before he really understands it's not supposed to do what he just did. And it's terrible. It's really disheartening.
Well, and you're really pointing out the what I think is the beauty of teaching is that combination of the art of teaching with the science of teaching. And knowing what you have to know about your content area is critical, but also having that ability to step into the life of that child that sits in front of you and try to see the world through that seventh grader's eyes or that 10th grader's eyes. Or I teach undergraduates, and so for my, you know, 21 to 25-year-old students' eyes, that's when I think you have the ability to really make education what it needs to be for that student, to make it meaningful.
Yeah. Well, this is a very slight shift, but I think the basic point is correct. A lot of people complain about math education on the same grounds because math teachers are primarily people who are always good at math, and they never had a period where they had a hard time with it.
Mm-hmm.
They don't understand that not everyone likes it just for its own sake. And reading, I would imagine, would probably be a little easier in that sense because you just get to pick what you're going to read. So if you are into, you know, adventure stories, you can do that. Or if you're into, you know, romance or serious literature or whatever it is that you're into, you get to pick it. But I would imagine even for kids, they don't know that. They don't know that there's so many things out there that they'll be able to.
You know, they don't know that it's out there. It's like a kid said to me one time in the library when I said, are you going to get a book? And And she said, you know, I hope you're not going to tell me what everyone else says. And I said, what's that? And she said that the library is filled with good books. And I said, well, what's wrong with saying that to you? And she said, where are they? And I looked at this child and I realized that when I walk into a library, I know authors, I know my interest, I know genre, I can find my way around the library. But this kid had no idea how to find a book that might be appealing to her because she had never developed any of that ability to find her way around to get to the good books. You know, your comment about kids can choose what they want to read, sometimes that's the problem. They don't know what they want to read, and many times in many schools, we don't give them choice for what they want to read. And so they're constantly being pushed into doing more of academic reading or efferent level reading, where they're just trying to read to take away information to answer a question. And that level of reading is not going to be whatever connects someone to reading as a lifetime endeavor.
I appreciate the comments of the caller. I want to jump in here because I think I should introduce again the guest for people who might have just joined us. And we're talking in this hour of Focus 580 with Kylene Beers. She's professor of education at University of Houston. And we're talking about connecting kids with reading. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, this is the first in what we hope to be a regular series, a program every month, looking at various literacy issues. And our partner on this project is the National Council of Teachers of English, based here in Urbana. And I expect in some future program we may well talk about teaching methods of teaching reading and some of the debate and discussion there. Just I'm thinking though about the question that the first caller asked, who obviously was a colleague, a peer, you know, somebody in your business. And I'm wondering about if we look at kids who seem to be reluctant readers. To what extent do you think that part of the problem is that, in fact, they may also be struggling readers and that they're just having a difficult time with the physical act of reading?
There's a huge overlap. I would say probably 80% of our kids who don't want to read, who fall into that category we'll call illiterate, are kids who struggle with reading. Now, here's an interesting number to keep in mind. About 80% of all of our students who graduate from high school, okay, so these are the ones that graduate, not our kids that drop out at 9th, 10th, 11th grade, but the ones that make it all the way through with us, about 80% of those kids tell us they will never again voluntarily read another book. Now, if they have to read it, many of those kids will go on to college and they'll certainly read what they have to read there. But 80% are telling us they're never going to voluntarily read another book. That is an incredible number. Tie that to what happens in first grade. Almost 100% of all kids who go to school on the first day of first grade want to learn to read. You know, that first grade excitement? And they all rush in, and they want to figure out how to do it on that very first day. If you go back one more step, it's only about 20% of our kids who come to school on the first day of first grade having been read to extensively all of those preschool years. And I'm really defining preschool as about age 6 months through that first day of first grade. So it seems that that 20% who come in with this tremendous background in having been read to are maybe the same 20% that leave at the end of 12th grade still very connected to books. Hmm. And something's happening in those 12 years in school that's convincing kids that reading is about accomplishing a task, reading is about passing a test, reading is about finishing your homework, but reading is not something you go out and do on your own for personal enjoyment and personal growth.
Well, that, again, I have callers, the lines are full. I want to promise you folks I will get right to them. But that gets back to a point, in a sense, it's the point you were making before, and that is that I know that if you ask people about how can you get children excited about reading, one of the answers they will give you is they say, well, You have to find something that the child wants to read. Mm-hmm. You got to get something that the kid will be jazzed about. And that makes me wonder whether, in fact, when teachers select materials for the children to read, that content may be one of the last things that they think about. That is, in a sense, of having some content that is meaningful that the child is going to want to read, and not read merely because he or she is obligated to do that, but that there's something in there that they decide that they want.
Mm-hmm. That becomes so important, especially at middle school and high school. I mean, it's as simple as we've got solid research that tells us boys want to read a book where the boy is a main character. Girls would prefer a book where the female is a main character, but girls seem a little more willing to accept a male as main character. And I think if you'll think about it this way, many adult women enjoy books by Grisham, but not many men rush out and buy the next Danielle Steele novel. And we see that all the way through adulthood. And yet most English teachers are women, and as they choose books, they find those books where the main character is a female, and then they're surprised that their, 13-year-old boys in their classroom don't enjoy that book. I mean, one of the simplest things teachers can do is to back away from teaching the particular book and instead focus on teaching a theme. And when you teach a theme, that allows you to bring in the same types of books, and some with boys as main characters, some with girls as main characters, some that are fiction, some that are nonfiction. The whole world just opens up, and kids become much more attached to what they're reading.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk with some other callers. The next person in line would be in Urbana on line number one.
Hello.
Yes.
I have four short comments, and then I'll hang up and listen. First, if you don't grow up in a home where there are books in the home and where you see the parents enjoying reading, putting a value on reading, then I don't think you'll have children who read. Second, this is such a visual society now that I actually think brains work differently from the way they did before, when people were readers before television, etc. Three, at one time I was producing a video, and I handed scripts to the lighting director and the camera director, and they kept asking me questions, and I kept pointing to the script where the directions were. And I finally realized that they don't see the printed word as having information. And four, there are readers and there are readers. I don't think to get people reading, children reading, that the content is as important as teaching them how to make inferences from their reading. I've been in book discussion groups where everything was taken literally, where you did not draw inferences and take off, from the basic information into all kinds of areas. So those are my four comments, and I'll hang up now.
Okay. Well, I this is the very first point that the caller raises, is one, and I wanted to make sure at least we talked for a minute or two during the program, and that is something that I'm sure that all educators would say, and that is that teachers in schools can only do so much, and that if parents want their children to be readers, they need to read to them, and they need to have their children know that books are important, and they need to see their parents read. And that's something that I know people in your field have been talking about for, well, about as long as I can remember.
You know, it's the answer that parents many times, though, don't want to hear. A study came out in 1984 titled Becoming a Nation of Readers, and it's been one of the landmark studies in reading. And it very clearly said that the single best predictor, and that's a pretty powerful phrase right there, the single best predictor of how well a child will do in school is not gender, is not socioeconomic status, it's not ethnicity, it's not birth order, are you the first child, the third, or the fifth, it's not class size, it's not if you're in an urban, rural, or suburban area. It is simply how much you were read to prior to the first day of first grade. Now, what's interesting is you don't have to be read to by just mom. So many parents now, or children are in families where both parents work, or where there is only one parent and that parent works. And moms and dads constantly say to me, but I can't read to my kid. I'm simply not there for it to happen. And my answer always is, when you're looking at that child care setting for your child, and the child care director says to you, look at our wonderful video library. Kids can watch Barney, they can watch Sesame Street, they can watch Blue's Clues. Look at that person and say, show me your book library. And when the director says, you know, in the morning the children come in and everything's quiet because they gather around these four different television monitors and watch television and it's only educational TV, stop that person and say, and when do they gather around a teacher and have a book read to them? It doesn't have to be just mom reading to the child. It just needs to be the more proficient reader reading to the child. And when we talk about extensive, it really means extensive. I mean, we're talking about 20 to 30 minutes a day, about 5 or 6 days a week for many, many years. Now, what's nice is reading to children isn't like doing exercise. You don't have to do it 1 minute after the other for 20 consecutive minutes to have the benefit. You know, with a toddler, you can read for 3 minutes here and 5 minutes there and 7 or 8 minutes right before bedtime, and the impact, the overall impact, is what counts. Many times parents don't want to hear that answer because it's not a program they can go buy, it's not a kit, it's not a tutor they can hire. It's something they've got to make the time to do or make sure that time is put in front of the child. But the benefits are overwhelmingly positive.
I have a number of other callers. I just don't wanted to say if you maybe wanted to respond to one of the other points that the previous caller raised, I'd give you a chance to do that.
She had great points, and I especially liked her bringing up this issue of what a visual society we are. Mm-hmm. Because I hear parents say to me a lot, oh, my child just so enjoys either what's, you know, on the Internet or what's on television that what's on the page just doesn't hold his interest. And then I show that parent any one of a number of books, and their eyes light up and say, I didn't know. Anybody should just wander into a bookstore or into a library and go over to the nonfiction section and pull out almost any book that's been published in the last 6-7 years, and you will see that publishers are well aware that children like a lot of diversity on the page. And that is there on a book page for kids. So I think what we can do is use that notion that kids like diversity as they are experiencing the world and see that the same thing is happening in books.
We'll go on to another caller here. Just real quick, I'll mention again, our guest is Kylene Beers. She's professor of education at University of Houston. We're talking about connecting kids with reading. And we have a number of other callers. And the next person in line would be our line number 3. And this person is in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. I'm certainly enjoying this program and topic, and I look forward to future shows. I hope you'll expand it to include other topics like math, and lots of kids have problems in other areas. I'm going back to the call from the young man earlier who touched on a lot of things that I have noticed and comments that have concerned me from teachers. The fact that when you like something, it's just unbelievable that somebody else doesn't. And I'm not sure that when kids come to school in kindergarten and don't know how to read or are, we'll say, behind, as another caller said, well, you know, if their parents don't read and they don't have books in their home, they won't be readers. And that's kind of an excuse. Time is short, and so, you know, the teacher gives her attention where it seems to do the most good. And I was very pleased at that point, your comment about, you know, accepting these people and presenting them things to them in a way that they can appreciate. And I guess I'm wondering how we can get into the colleges of education an appreciation for people who are different, not just color, not just sex, but people who've had a totally different experience than we have. And as I've had an opportunity to speak to some very much older people who have been teachers, and the thing I noticed about them as individuals, I've been trying to kind of figure this out a little bit, was that they felt privileged and that it was an honor to be able to go to college and get an education. And it still is. And they felt, I believe, they all had gone back to their communities and done very worthwhile things, teach many, and I was surprised how many, teaching, stopping, staying home with their own children, and returning to teaching as in middle age when their children were out of the house, basically. They seem to feel, I'm going to use the word obligation, but one they happily embraced to pass on their privilege to people who hadn't had it, to teach that little child who had never seen a book, and to try to find something, you know, that would really excite that child. And it seemed to me they were more accepting of people from other socioeconomic groups than some people seem to be today. And I hear kindergarten teachers speaking somewhat like the earlier caller. Well, you know, their parents never read to them, their parents work, they never see them. What can I do? And I think we're using that as an excuse to kind of avoid people who are different and we don't know how to approach. And I just like to hear your comments.
Well, it's a powerful comment that you're making, the notion that what can we be doing in colleges of education to help our new teachers coming into the field be more accepting of that wide range of diversity. And I think you're very wise to expand what diversity means, because it is far beyond just the color of one's skin. And I know that as I travel throughout this country and visit many, many college campuses, colleges of education are making, I think, bold and drastic changes in the teacher preparation. For instance, at the University of Houston, our students, long before they ever get into that traditional student teaching situation, are in our inner city schools just hanging out with kids, actually taking some of their college classes in those inner city schools where the professors are there with the teachers that are teaching the public school students and with our college students, so that they begin to see, long before they're standing in front of a classroom, what really a school climate is all about. We're always excited when we get those folks coming into education who have sort of had another career and now bring their expertise and their maturity to the classroom. That person is a tremendous asset in the school, but so is that young 23, 24, 25-year-old. We just have to help give them many more experiences than they probably just had at that point in their life.
Well, I appreciate, again, the comments of the caller. Let's go again to another person, and this is also someone in Champaign, and it is line number two. Hello.
Hi. Great, great subject. I want to speak to the last point that you just made. I went to the University of Illinois. I was in the psychology department, both as undergrad and graduate, but I did take a couple of programs in the teaching program. Just a couple classes just to be interested. It was, you know, something I just wanted to do. But what I found is that in the foundational classes, like the basics of American higher education, the basics of American education in general, the students who were in those programs were just in it way before they had the maturity or the academic ability themselves to really understand those topics. It was sophomores taking classes that were really pretty heavy-duty philosophy on why we educate people the way we do in this country, mm-hmm. and how that has kind of changed over the last 150 or 200 years. And I think that that's part of the problem, is that a lot of the students going into teaching, they're just simply not mature enough. They don't get it. They don't have the intellectual grounding. They don't have the training in philosophy and in basic thinking skills to understand the underpinnings of our educational system and the educational process. So I think that is actually one problem. And that might lead into the second point I was going to make. I think a lot of times kids don't read is because we simply ask them to read the wrong stuff. You know, how many high school or even junior high English classes make kids read Romeo and Juliet? What a bummer. What a drag for a kid that age to read that particular Shakespeare, when if you want to read Shakespeare, there's so many other great options out there. Much Ado About Nothing, just as an example. It's got humor in it, it's got excitement, it's got treachery, and yet we still get to really a nice story as we go through it. Why do they choose those kinds of things? I think it's just simply tradition. It's not any question about how kids learn. We just choose Romeo and Juliet because, well, that's what they've always chosen. I also wanted to comment about an earlier point that was made about, well, you know, how about not using technology so much, you know, just go to the video or go to the computer or whatever. I think that if you pair up some reading with some of the technology that's available, you might have a real positive outcome. And I can speak from my own experience. In high school, we read Othello from Shakespeare, which normally would be a downer, too, for a high school kid. Just don't have the maturity level to understand that kind of storyline. But they just use an old LP, an old recording, and we read along with the recording, and it really brought it alive. It had the sound effects. It had interesting character voices. We were able to stop after each scene and ask questions and talk about it, what happened. And I remember just as being a kid in that situation, it really made it come to life. So that, I think we can, instead of just simply saying, well, technology stinks and you know, we have no attention span because of TV and video and whatnot and computer games, maybe we can incorporate them together more effectively in the classroom so that we can get the best of both worlds. And then the third point, and then I'll go ahead and wind it up, is I know from my own experience that the group, somebody had mentioned earlier the parental example, you know, parents have to read too. That's one really good important thing. I want to agree with that completely. I'm glad they came up so early. The other one, though, is even if parents don't read, they should encourage their kids to read anything, anything whatsoever. If the kid likes to read comic books, well, at least that's a start in getting into the habit of daily reading. If the kid wants to read those, I guess, a little bit more advanced comic novels, whatever they call them again. We talked about them yesterday.
Graphic novels.
On the program. Yeah, the graphic novels. Even that is better than reading nothing. If they just want to read Goosebumps, as the one kid's series that I can think of offhand, if they want to read just Harry Potter, great, that's a start. You know, to me, the key is it gets them in the habit of reading something.
Yeah, you raised so many good points, and we're really getting short on time.
That's at least
all
right. Thank you very much for your patience. Well, I'll just listen.
I thank you, and I just wanted to give Professor Beers a chance to comment on a couple of things that the caller said.
Boy, they were good points. I'll sort of start where he ended and work backwards. Parents and teachers really do need to be open to letting kids move through what we call an unconscious delight stage of reading. And that's where kids just find what it is that works for them. And if it's comic books, great. If it's graphic novels, great. If it's Goosebumps, Hardy Boys, Babysitter Clubs, it's that ability to pick up a book where the format is going to be familiar to you. Maybe the characters are going to be familiar from book to book to book, and just get lost in that book. Almost every adult who is a lifetime reader remembers that stage. Whether it was the Bobbsey twins, Trixie Belden, Hardy Boys, they remember that stage where they just read book after book after book of the same kind of book. So we've got to give kids that opportunity to do that. And sometimes it means teachers have to be willing to say, oh, well, yes, you can use the Goosebumps book here for your book report. What a kid sees as good literature and what a teacher sees as good literature many times are going to be two very different things. This notion of parents having to read to kids or parents reading in front of their kids, we just can't say enough about that. Many times parents are so busy being good parents that they never take the time to just sit down and read a book, and it means maybe dinner doesn't get cooked on time, maybe the house didn't get cleaned up on time, but the kid sees the parent reading the book. Too many times kids say, well, my mom and dad really don't like to read. They want me to do it because it's what's just good for me. Kids are real smart. If they don't see that parents themselves value it but are simply trying to push it off on the kids, then it's a problem. So I would disagree with the caller just a bit that
if the parents don't like to read, the parent themselves must find that one thing that they're willing to read in front of the kids.
All right. We just have about 8-9 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Kylene Beers. She's professor of education at University of Houston. We're talking about connecting kids with reading, and we will go on. And the next person is someone in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Following up on that last comment, I wasn't smart enough to do it. This with my own kids who are now adults, but I have friends who continued reading with their kids, to their kids, books that the kids were interested in to their high school years,
mm-hmm.
Science fiction or whatever. I think that's a marvelous idea. This whole idea of knowing what to read, I think, is a problem for lots of us. I remember I really loved reading. I read book after book as a kid, spent my summers under a tree reading, and I wasn't at camp. But in college, I stopped reading. I didn't know what to read. And finally, after moving here, I found a book group. And one of the joys of the book group is that we share ideas of what to read. Mm-hmm. I think it's really sad that Oprah Winfrey has stopped her book club, because I think that it was one of the things that gave people ideas, of the people who watched her, of some books to read and people to discuss them with. And it was like a community of people you could all discuss the same book with. Have you read Oprah's book of the month? I can imagine friends saying that. I have a friend who is now a librarian in an elementary school in Champaign, and she only can work part-time because they don't have the money for a full-time librarian, so she only has time to spend her time teaching library skills. She doesn't have time to get to know the kids and know what they are reading and to be there to see when they check out books. So she can't suggest to them, well, if you like this book, you might like this book, because she doesn't see the kids.
Well, and that's one of the real tragedies of education, where we've cut back significantly the role of the librarian in the school. And it began to happen when we stopped calling that person a librarian, and the person became a media specialist and suddenly was taken away from books. You know, librarians have an incredible opportunity. They're the ones that see kids, say, in an elementary school year after year after year, and can truly watch that child's reading interests develop. Finding books is perhaps not as hard as it seems. This program is co-sponsored by NCTE, the National Council of Teachers of English, and every couple years they put out a wonderful, wonderful series of books at the elementary level, middle school level, and high school level that help teachers connect with books. The elementary book is called Adventuring with Books, and the middle school books are called Your Reading, and the high school books are called Books for You. And teachers and librarians, and I suppose even parents, have access to those books simply by ordering through NCTE. You can also go online to the American Library Association site, which is www.ala.org, and they keep updated lists, many, many, many lists, in all different areas, mystery books, multicultural books, books for reluctant readers. You have to play around with that site some to find those different lists, but there's ways to find lists of books. You can just go online to Google.com and type in book lists, and lots of lists will pop up for you to look at.
We just have a couple of minutes left. I want to at least try to get one more caller. We have someone next up in Chicago on line three.
Hi, I just wanted to make a quick comment about the parental example. The mystery writer Dale Furutani was raised, his foster father was a moron, and he grew up watching his foster father struggling to read a newspaper, and because he admired his father so much, he just thought, this must be gold. Anything that takes this man's time that he put so much energy to must be important. And he decided as a result to become a writer, and I believe he was the first Asian American to win the Edgar Award for mystery writing. So I think my point is that it doesn't matter if the parent can barely read. They don't have to have even a college education. It's their attitude towards reading that makes an indelible impression upon the child and leads to perhaps more Dale Furutanis. Thank you.
That's a great story, and it is. I mean, it's the way the parent approaches any task
and it's not just reading, it's any task, that children pick up on how much the parent values that, and many times, if we're lucky, take on those same values themselves.
Hmm. Well, you know, we're coming down to the point where we have a couple of minutes left, and I appreciate all of the questions that the callers have raised, so many good ones, and I want to mention again, as we did at the beginning of the program, that this show here is the first one of what now will be a monthly series looking at various literacy issues, different topics, different guests. I am certain that we will be getting back to some of these subjects in the future, so I hope people can follow along and would participate in some future programs. We're coming down to the point we have a minute or two left, and I guess I want to give you the chance, Professor Beers, if there's something you'd like to, an idea you'd like to leave people with or something you'd like to talk about here for a minute or two in the time that remains so that we can do that.
You know, I think if I could leave people with anything, it would be to remember that there are many, many children out there in the nation who are in classrooms every day with teachers who are doing an incredible job of helping those kids connect to books. And when the public sees a chance to go into a school and help teachers do an even better job by volunteering to read aloud to kids, volunteering to work in the library before school or after school to help kids check out books, volunteering to tutor children who are having trouble with reading, all of that makes a tremendous difference as the public shows their support for what our teachers are doing.
Hmm. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today. We certainly appreciate it and help us get this series launched.
It's a great series. I appreciate being a part of it.
Our guest, Kylene Beers, she is professor of education at the University of Houston.